Scrolling for May 24th, 2020. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Mr. Square Toes.
And I'm Pam Bedour.
Square Toes and Sand Shoes. I know that neither of you get the Sand Shoes joke because of the Doctor Who reference, but that's all I can think of when Sherlock goes, oh, he's Sand Shoes and he's Granddad. He's giving names to the suspects just based on the only thing that he knows about them is the type of shoes that they're wearing.
They were walking arm in arm, Steve.
Oh, we're on chapter 4 of A Study in Scarlet, and we are into this mystery.
And the chapter 4 title says it all. This is a pretty short chapter. It's about what John Rantz had to tell, as the chapter is titled. Now, the chapter opens at the telegraph office where Holmes dispatches, quote, a long telegram. And I don't know if Watson has seen the telegram. Who is it to? What does it say? We don't really have a lot of ideas about that, do we?
No, just this line that says, I saw him send a long telegram. And then there's this piece of dialogue that Doyle throws in, and it's Sherlock saying, there is nothing like firsthand evidence. And that's the whole line. There is no more to it than that. I don't know what Doyle was trying to say with those words.
He says a little more. He says, there's nothing like firsthand evidence, he remarked. As a matter of fact, my mind is entirely made up upon the case, but still we may as well learn what there is to be learned. And I think he's saying there, listen, we just went and saw the scene. So I think I already know what's going on here, but we better go see John Rantz, the constable who was there the moment after it happened, and find out what he knows.
But none of that is contextual, Pam. You are adding words to Doyle to make sense of this offhand comment. Is this offhand comment about the telegram? Because it is the phrase directly after the statement that there was a telegram, a mysterious telegram that was sent.
Well, it's chapter 4, and Doyle is telling the reader that Sherlock has already solved this, but you guys have another, about 8 and 9 chapters to go.
Right. It is a way of engaging the reader. I like that.
So they go off to see John Rantz, the constable, who was the first one on the scene of the murder, kind of an important eyewitness.
And then as they're driving over there, Sherlock talks Watson through how he came up with the profile. And everything's super logical. And Watson's like, you know, as usual, oh, that's, now that you explain it, I can see it perfectly. And then there's just one detail left at the end of the description. And the florid face, I asked. Ah, that was a more daring shot, though I have no doubt that I was right. You must not ask me that at the present state of affairs, says Sherlock.
That's two mysteries that Doyle is giving us in chapter 4. What the heck does Sherlock mean by you must not ask me about that right now? Mm-hmm. It will come up later. This is, again, the publication of this, Doyle published this whole book at Christmas of 1887. This was not chapter by chapter. This is, you know, keep reading kind of text here.
Yeah, and it's important, I would say, to note that, because what we can do is by noting this particular, I don't know, clue, we're not supposed to ask him about this right now, whether Holmes is correct later on when the reveal happens.
Weird. It's just weird to throw these sorts of writings into chapter 4 for us to keep investigating, but we've already bought the magazine. It was all published all at the same time.
Yeah, but it's not all, I mean, come on, it's a work of art, my friends. It's not all marketing.
A lot of it's marketing with Doyle.
Now, and Watson here really shows himself that the first story that he chronicles for his good friend Holmes, he proves very helpful to the reader, not to Holmes, in summarizing the key questions. I like how he's just like, okay, guys, here's what was happening. My head is in a whirl, I remarked. The more one thinks of it, the more mysterious it grows. How came these two men, if there were two men, into an empty house? What has become of the cabman who drove them? How could one man compel another to take poison? Where did the blood come from? What was the object of the murder, since robbery had no part in it? How came the woman's ring there? Above all, why should the second man write up the German word Rach before decamping? I confess that I cannot see any possible way of reconciling all these facts. My companion smiled approvingly. You sum up the difficulties of the situation succinctly and well, he said. And so, a lot of questions. I didn't count them. It was like 8 questions. And Sherlock is like, good job. You have seen all the questions that we need to answer. I've personally already answered them, but good job.
You've observed nothing. You've seen all of this, but you've observed nothing. Good job, Watson.
Doyle is basically setting out. He goes, I need to answer all these questions by the end of this
exactly.
It's really nice of him to lay that out for us, the reader. We might need this summary. Chip, you mentioned in The Hound of the Baskervilles how much you didn't like all the summaries, but this is a pretty good summary of the case up to this point.
Yeah, and I mean, so far, I've enjoyed this story better than The Hound of the Baskervilles.
You're wrong. Once again, we get young Holmes's need for approval and the representation of the detective as magician once again.
Oh, I like this part. He says, I'm not going to tell you much more of the case, Doctor. You know a conjurer gets no credit when once he has explained his trick. And if I show you too much of my method of working, you will come to the conclusion that I'm a very ordinary individual after all. I shall never do that, I answered. You have brought detection as near an exact science as it ever will be brought in this world. My companion flushed up with pleasure at my words and the earnest way in which I uttered them. I had already observed that he was as sensitive to flattery on the score of his art as any girl could be of her beauty. Ooh, there's a lot to unpack here, my friends.
We've seen these traits before where Holmes really does like the admiration that he gets. He tries to say that he doesn't, but Watson can see how much he really enjoys this flattery.
Flattery gets you everywhere.
And you can see there he says, like, I don't want you to think I'm a very ordinary individual. He wants to be extraordinary. Like, that's part of his self-identity. And Watson understands that perfectly and says, buddy, you are extraordinary.
Well, Penn and Teller use the same kind of conversation when they talk about their magic. Because if you ever catch them after a show or somewhere and you ask them how a trick is done, they will explain it to you. But most people, they really don't want to know how the trick is done. And the other part is once they realize how the trick is done, it becomes very ordinary and not mysterious. So, I mean, I can totally see what Sherlock Holmes is saying here. Listen, if you knew my method, you're not going to think I'm that special. But, you know, I have some expertise.
And once again, we can see Doyle writing as a young 27-year-old and talking about young women and beauty and comparing that beauty to these situations with these men here. Very interesting, young Mr. Doyle.
And remember that Lestrade and Gregson are as jealous as a pair of professional beauties, right? So now it's like Holmes too. Like, there's something about this rather new profession of the detective, whether it's a police detective or a private consulting detective, as Holmes calls himself, there is this sense of the detective as sort of like a possible celebrity, maybe?
Mm-hmm. There is certainly that. The sensational literature that he enjoys so much, he certainly seems like he wants to be a part of it at this phase in his career. Maybe later he says, no, I don't want the credit for this. But maybe he's not being very truthful at that point.
And later he has Watson writing the stories, which people read. Like, you know how they run into people who are like, oh, I read the story. So he doesn't need to be in the newspapers because he's in the magazines, which is even better in a way.
Right. They go to John Rance, the constable who was the first one on the scene, and they pump him for information. And very subtly, Sherlock is rolling a half sovereign between his fingers while he's talking, enticing this man to give up the information that they need.
Just rolling that coin back and forth. Maybe this is money here. Maybe I have this. Maybe I don't have this, right?
This $100 bill is getting a little heavy. I'll just put it on the desk here.
Maybe I'll forget it. You never know. You never know.
How much is a half sovereign?
It's a half pound, half of an English pound. And so that would be about the buying power of 75-ish dollars today.
Okay. So, all right.
So it's very similar to that $100 bill that was so heavy that I just left it on your desk.
So they talked to John Rance, and unfortunately, he actually saw this drunken guy, apparently drunken guy, the night of the murder, who is a perfect match for Sherlock's description. So John Rance actually had his hand on the guy that Sherlock and Watson are looking for. So John Rance, not exactly Stanley Hopkins, right?
Yeah. Well, that's later on. Later on.
Right. This is he's just a street cop. He's just, you know, the first one on the scene, and Sherlock needs him as much as he needs him and is not going to be mentoring him very much.
No. He says, "There's a half sovereign for you," my companion said, standing up and taking his hat. "I am afraid, Rance, that you will never rise in the force. That head of yours should be for use as well as ornament. You might have gained your sergeant's stripes last night. The man whom you held in your hands is the man who holds the clue of this mystery and whom we are seeking."
I love that.
That is some... I don't think even that is a backhanded compliment. I don't think there is compliment there.
No, that is definitely you think you are not using your head well, sir.
You are at the height of your profession. Get used to it. Oh my goodness, young man!
And like any extra cash that you are going to earn is going to be through like very occasional bribes like this and not through an actual increased salary as you rise through the ranks.
Okay, wow. So he is mentoring him a little bit.
No, he's not. You think?
Well.
Learn to take bribes, young man. Welcome to the police force.
Oh my goodness.
Chicago is your future. We get to the ending. Watson asks why the criminal went back to the scene, because this whole drunk man, quote unquote, is the criminal going back to the scene afterwards.
And you guys, I really like this ending. I'll be curious what you guys thought. Let me quickly read through the last two paragraphs, but there's a
quickly read through two paragraphs. Go ahead.
The ring, man, the ring. That was what he came back for. If we have no other way of catching him, we can always bait our line with the ring. I shall have him, Doctor. I'll lay you 2-1 that I have him. I must thank you for it all. I might not have gone but for you, and so have missed the finest study I ever came across. A study in scarlet, eh? Why shouldn't we use a little art jargon? There's the scarlet thread of murder running through the colorless skein of life, and our duty is to unravel it and isolate it and expose every inch of it. And now for lunch, and then for Norman Neruda. Her attack and her bowing are splendid. What's that little thing of Chopin's she plays so magnificently? Da-la-la-la-la-la-la-la. Leaning back in the cab.
I didn't know what you were going to do there. I didn't know you were going to do the tra-la-la-la-lee-ra-lee-ra-lee.
I can't do it, man. I can't do it. Leaning back in the cab, this amateur bloodhound caroled away like a lark while I meditated upon the many-sidedness of the human mind. End of chapter. You guys, this is such a great ending. What did you notice? Other than, like, it's really awkward to do singing in prose.
That's right. Well, one of the things that I noticed is that Doyle is very good at writing dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And I've noticed that through the entire book. And it's very difficult to write, you know, the cadence of dialogue. And it just seems to just roll off the reader's mind as they go through it. And I marvel at that, that how skilled he is.
I think that his publisher decided that the title of this story needed to be A Study in Scarlet because it was originally called...
That's right. It was originally called A Tangled Skein. Yeah, that's right. And so either way, the title was going to come from this section.
And I think that this is a dialogue that Doyle is having with his publisher here. A study in Scarlet, eh? Well, why shouldn't we use a little art jargon? There's the scarlet thread of murder running through the colorless skein of life. We could have called it the title that I used.
It's also super common at this time for dime novels in the U.S. and penny dreadfuls in England to end the whole novel with the title. That was a very common move. So now this isn't quite that, but it is near the end of a chapter and actually using the title and telling you, like, this is why this book is called what it is. And there's also that notion of a scarlet thread of murder that runs through the, you know, tangled business, this colorless tangled business that is life. And so, of course, you know, from like a citizen's perspective, a murder is a huge disruption, right, to life. But from a detective's perspective, that's the work, right? That's the detective is unraveling, isolating whatever the disruption is, exposing the disruption. So this is kind of a meditation on, like, what is the detective's work? What is the detective's role within a modern urban society?
Beautiful. Wonderful. And we get one of the first times that Watson and Holmes go to the theater and listen to some music here.
Yes. And Wilma Norman Neruda was this very famous Moravian violinist. And so they're going to, like, she's playing Chopin. So it'll be a full orchestra performance, I'm sure.
And she was a real person, right?
Yep. Yep.
Well, which leads back to the thought that Holmes and Watson were real people.
Exactly. The verisimilitude that we've talked about before. Yeah. And it also goes back to, like, well, so of course, Holmes is a violinist too, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when you play an instrument, like watching someone play your own instrument has a very different feeling to it than watching someone play other instruments that you don't personally partake in.
Wonderful. We still have a couple of mysteries in chapter four that we need to uncover. That telegram at the beginning, we still are in the dark about what that is. The suspect's florid face, which Doyle specifically has Sherlock tell Watson, don't ask me about that right now. That'll be for later. And the drunk man in the street, the suspect, we're not sure who that is yet. And the very interesting quote, Sherlock asks the constable, was he carrying a whip? There's been no whip in this mystery up until that moment. So that's curious.
Guys, we are ready.
That's a wrap. We're ready for chapter five.
Wonderful. I hope everybody's out there listening and reading along and enjoying this with us. We would love to hear from you. Give us a call, give us a text, give us an email. Find our hashtag TMS Sherlock Holmes. Go to our website, sandwichesatirregularhours.com, for all these conversations all in one convenient spot so you can hear how silly we are. Because boy, oh boy, are we getting silly. This is wonderful. This is fantastic. I love doing this. I hope everybody out there is enjoying it as much as I am. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scroll. I'm Steve Fodor.
And I'm Mr. Square Shoes.
And I'm Pam Bedore.
Where are my sandwiches?
Release the sandwiches.